Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. We will be talking with Musa Albayoumi, Yara Salamed, and Mubarak Awad about calls for a ceasefire in the current Israel-Hamas war. Musa is an MD and chair of the board of the Kansas chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE Kansas. Yara is studying law at UMKC and is president of Students for Justice in Palestine there. Mubarak is a Palestinian born in Jerusalem in 1943, influenced by a Mennonite and Quaker missionaries. He received bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees, PhD degrees, from universities in the U.S. He became a U.S. citizen in 1978 and returned to Israel in 1983 to found the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence. He was expelled from Palestine in 1988 during the First Intifada for organizing nonviolent protests against mistreatment of Palestinians by Israeli military and settlers. Back in the U.S., he founded Nonviolence International. Musa, and he's also taught for many years. He's now professor emeritus from American University. Is that right, in Washington, D.C.? I'm not hearing him. Are you? So hang on, Mubarak, just a moment. I've got to adjust. I've got to check my output. Output, external headphones. It's supposed to go, I see, here we go. Okay, go ahead, Mubarak.
That's right.
It's only barely hearing. I'm only barely hearing. What? Can you talk a little bit louder or turn your microphone up?
Yeah, that's right, I said, regarding to the American University teaching there.
Okay, so anybody else? Musa is and Yara, if I please correct any errors or add anything you'd like to that.
You did fine.
Yeah, you did great.
Okay, is that loud enough, Craig? Okay. So I've got to turn up my earphone here, headphone, just a little bit if I can. So Musa, tell us what's the Council on American and Islamic Relations.
Sure. The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CAIR for short, C-A-I-R, is America's largest and oldest civil rights and advocacy organization. And its mission is to enhance the understanding of Islam, protect civil rights, promote justice, and empower American Muslims. Of course, CAIR is a nonprofit grassroots organization with chapters and affiliate offices nationwide. I think at last count, we had 37 offices in different states.
Mm-hmm.
Its national headquarters is located on the Capitol Hill, right next to our Capitol building in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C.
So you have a chapter in Kansas, but not in Missouri?
We have one in Kansas, and it covers the whole city of Kansas, plus we cover the whole Kansas City metropolitan area, including the parts of Missouri that fall in the Kansas City metropolitan area. And then the one in Missouri is actually headquartered in St. Louis.
Okay. Great. So Yara, tell us about Students for Justice in Palestine.
Yeah, for sure. So our student organization at UMKC is called Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP for short. It's a chapter of the larger and national SJP organization. Our primary purpose is to educate and advocate for the liberation of Palestine and the rights of Palestinians. We do the education portion by holding regular teach-ins, tabling events, and panel events on our campus. And we usually do open up to the KC community in general, so they come to our campus as well to learn about Palestinian history and current events. In terms of advocacy work, we act as representatives for our student body on campus by meeting with UMKC administration and the Student Government Association to protect students who feel they'll face academic or future professional repercussions for voicing support for Palestine. In these meetings, we also released a statement with our Student Government Association calling for all those in positions of power to put international pressure to intervene and on the Israeli regime to end the genocide of Palestinians and the siege of Gaza.
The siege of Gaza.
Yes.
Gaza. Sorry.
I did it the Arabic way.
Of course.
Essentially, SJP is just meant to be a comfortable space for students in the community to learn and use it as an outlet to voice support for the Palestinian cause.
Right, right. So there have been how many university presidents who were forced to resign recently because for...
There were three of them that were pushed to resign, but only two of them have resigned so far.
Okay, and talk about that.
Well, that's sad to talk about to start with.
Yeah.
The idea is these three university presidents were faced with a very, very unreasonable question in the in Congress when they were questioned by the Congress, because they were asked to give a yes or no answer to a question that cannot be answered with a yes or no. And they were asked if someone says genocide or describes something as genocide, if that will be acceptable on their campus. And when they tried to say it depends on the context, or if we're going to take action against them depending on the context when this was done or not, because in reality free speech protects people saying anything, even if it's an unpopular speech, and even sometimes hate speech is accepted as free speech. You don't have to like it, and you can stand against it, but it's not a crime. But the people in Congress were basically adamant that she either has to give yes or no answer. And when she told them it's a qualified yes or something like that, it depends on an answer, they raised hell, and they were taking her down, and this is unacceptable, all the stuff. And they basically forced the university to say that this is unacceptable for you to be promoting genocide of Jewish people on campus and not protecting them, and they forced her to resign.
So just a little more background about that. That there were, I mean, so there were student groups on campus who were asserting that what is happening in Gaza right now is genocide. Is that what they were being charged? I don't know. I haven't paid attention to those details, but
no one really talked about where the question came from. They were just asking her, if someone calls for genocide or says something about genocide on campus, is this something going to be acceptable, or are you going to do something about it?
Well, the question is whether somebody is promoting it or saying or opposing it, right?
Or calling for genocide, even if they're calling.
Someone calling for genocide. I see, right?
Or someone is accused of calling for genocide, whatever it is.
Oh yeah.
And they're asking her if the university is going to take action against that person, and she was trying to tell them that they don't take action against speech because speech is protected, but if that person takes that speech beyond the speech and starts acting on it or threatening. If somebody makes a threat of committing murder or genocide, then that is actionable. That's a crime. A threat is a crime.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Okay? But just saying something is not a crime.
At least it's not supposed to be a crime in the United States. Mubarak, right. Tell us about Nonviolence International.
Yeah, Nonviolence International. I started that program after my deportation from Palestine. And I was working over there with a lot of Palestinians, tried to push hard the whole concept of a different alternative to an armed struggle. And I think that it took so much energy from the Israeli government to stop me and stop the whole idea of promoting nonviolence. And in that time, the idea of when Israel will uproot, for example, olive trees, I'll bring thousands of olive trees and we plant them in areas where the Israeli take hundreds of thousand years olive trees out, uproot them and take them.
Yeah, just a bit more background. So some of the settlers were going out and bulldozing olive orchards belonging to Palestinian families. Is that correct?
To the Palestinian family. That's correct.
Right.
That's not necessarily the settlers. Sometimes the Israeli government is actually doing it.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And then with all what my activities are is that we as Palestinian, we should not pay a single penny tax for the Israeli to rule us, to occupy us. And we should not even accept any of their laws. We should not eat any of the food or drinks that they made. We have to eat our own food, our own drinks. And the Israeli felt very uneasy. And they took me to the Supreme Court, and I have and put me so many times in jail for just activities of nonviolence or promoting nonviolence. And then the Supreme Court plus the Prime Minister of Israel at that time was Shamir, said that I'm the most dangerous person in Palestine and is for the Israeli government, they have to get me out. So I was deported, and when I came out there, I was deported because I am a U.S. citizen. So the deportation was to United States. And when I came to United States, American University asked me to come and teach there at the American University. And I became professor there to teach. And then I started Nonviolence International, not only concentrated on the Palestinian issue, but also on other issue in the world, and try to push hard the work of a fellow by the name of Gene Sharp, who worked hard to bring nonviolence and activities there. So we traveled with Gene Sharp to Burma, to Tunis, to any place where they need, especially in Europe, they were interested in nonviolence more than in the United States, government-wise. And we try also to bring any person or any group or any countries who are interested and learning about nonviolence, and we have the ability of bringing groups to any place and teach methods and theory of nonviolence.
So it's my impression that the nonviolence of the First Intifada moved Israeli public opinion to the point that that Yitzhak Rabin he was defense minister and wound up running for prime minister on a platform of negotiating with Palestinians. But he also worked very hard to make sure that to terminate the nonviolence, right?
That's right. In that time, we were not that much clear about Israel's intent, what they are interested in the future for the Palestinian.
Right.
And in that time, there was a very strong feeling with the Palestinians that the more contacts with peace groups in Israel, that they could put a prime minister who would like to have peace between Palestinian and Israelis and try to have a civil society there.
And Rabin may have been slightly more amenable to that than his predecessor Shamir, but he cooperated with Arafat to destroy nonviolence, right?
And, 100 times.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right, and that's part of the background for, frankly, it's my opinion from studying your work and others that the current Israel-Hamas crisis would not have existed because if the Palestinians had been able to sustain nonviolent discipline?
Yes, but very, very unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand that Hamas was really, in the beginning of Hamas, it was supported by Israel.
And it was also nonviolent in the beginning.
And it was nonviolence, but and I'll give you a small example. If you want to put a leaflet or you want to put things on the walls or speak on that, they could arrest us.
Yeah,
but if
indeed.
A fellow from Hamas, they would not arrest them. And the idea of Israel at that time is they want to destroy the idea of the PLO and to say here is another group that they could fight the PLO.
Interesting. Okay, well, listen, we should give some more time to our Musa and Yara to talk about what how the current Israel-Hamas war is impacting people here in the greater Kansas City area.
Well, in reality, this current crisis is affecting everybody worldwide, nationwide, and including in our current area. There are a lot of people that live in Kansas, and with a big concentration in the Kansas City metro area, of people who are connected to that part of the world. And they know people there, they have families there. And the impact on them on both sides, whether it's the group that have immediate family there, or people that just are connected to the area without having immediate family there. And the immediate impact comes in the form of people suffering heartbreaking losses of members of both their immediate family and extended families as a result of the atrocities committed each day by the Israeli forces in Gaza. Okay? And believe it or not, simultaneously, also atrocities are taking place in the West Bank. It's not only limited to Gaza. Right? We have seen many people testifying about seeing 10 members of their families who were killed and the house that they used to live in collapsing over every member of their family, over their heads. And as a result, all their family members are killed in one instant.
Yes.
Okay. When that house collapsing over their heads, including young children and women. Okay. Right now, we're talking about over 27,000 people killed in Gaza. And mostly civilians, for the most part, most of these are civilians, and about 70% of them are children and women. And these losses affect the people's lives here. And I've heard, I remember clearly stuck in my head, the scene of a young woman in Kansas City that talked about her own grandfather, that she saw him for the last time in July, after she has been prevented from seeing him for 10 years because of the restrictions on travel to Gaza. But she went last July and saw her grandfather for the first time in 10 years and then came back. And then he was killed during those events. Not because he was killed with a bomb or by shooting or anything during the attack. He was killed because he was an elderly man and he had kidney disease and he needed to have clean water. And he couldn't have it. When they took him to the hospital and they tried to find clean intravenous solution to inject into his blood to keep him alive, they didn't have any. And he died because of the lack of clean water or clean medical supplies. In addition to that, she had more than 10 or 15 of her family members that were also killed in Gaza, including the latest child that she had seen was only 2 years old, the cutest child that she saw and how happy he was, and this child now is still alive, but his parents and all his family were killed. And this young woman was in tears. She couldn't hold her tears when she was talking to one of our local elected officials about this incident. And these things, you can't avoid having to affect you to the core of your being. Okay?
Indeed not.
And in addition to that, just for the local impact, just think, as an organization, we in CARE, we keep receiving a lot of reports, okay, and we have been involved in many cases of rising anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian and anti-Muslim incidents after the events that started on October 7th.
Right.
And these were not only people from the supporter of Israel. On the contrary, these are people that are receiving this treatment and these hate incidents from their employers or the schools where they work or they go to or the universities where they attend and all this, and it's affecting their lives in so many different ways, and we're still working every single day to provide support to them and stem the tide of discrimination that's affecting them after these events started.
Exactly. So we are talking with Musa El-Bayoumi, Yara Salamat, and Mubarak Awad. Musa is the board chair of Kansas chapter of the Council on American and Islamic Relations, CARE Kansas. Yara is a law student at UMKC and president of Students for Justice in Palestine there. Mubarak founded Nonviolence International after he was expelled from Palestine for organizing nonviolent protests during the first Intifada, protesting mistreatment by Israeli military and settlers. So Yara, so what do you, first of all, I assume we all agree that the attacks by Hamas on October 7th were atrocious and should not have happened, right?
Well, that's a loaded question.
That's a loaded question. Fine. Okay. But in any case, you're calling for a ceasefire, right?
Correct. The idea, again, is we're talking about what happened on October 7th, okay? We have to start by saying we are against the killing of civilians of either side.
Okay.
Innocent civilians should not be killed by anybody. We're
right.
not here to defend Hamas. But in the meantime, when you look at what happened on October 7th, you can't take it in isolation. You have to take it in the context and the full picture of what was happening for the last 75 years, what was happening to the Gaza people in the last 15 years and the siege that they're under and how it's impacting their life and the attacks that they happen from the Israeli side, okay, and no one talks about it. And
right.
those people, if they spurted in this act, although we disagree with it, especially because it's affecting some civilians, but you have to understand what started it and where it came from. So the solution should be to resolve the roots of the problem rather than blaming this. And I know that this is something we're going to come to. Does, quote unquote, Israel have the right to defend itself? It's another loaded question. Because every person and every entity, they have the right to defend themselves. But in reality, you have to define what defending themselves means.
Okay? And you also have to worry about what's effective and what's not. And my sense is from, I started in 95 studying the spectacular collapse of the Soviet bloc almost without firing a shot. And what I came to was when people are killed and property is destroyed, the apparent perpetrators often make enemies. But the major media distort the reporting so that few people understand what's motivating people, so that, people are driven to engage in support counterproductive violence.
Correct. But we also have to look at what is being projected as acts of self-defense. Are they really self-defense, or are they really an exaggerated form of attack and designed to be an act of aggression to achieve a long-held political target or political goal disguised as an act of attack, as an act of self-defense? That's not really self-defense. And the scale, would the scale of defense include displacement of hundreds of thousands of people from their homes?
Really, the point here is, and your claim in a nutshell, if I'm correct, is that the Israeli response to the October 7th attacks is totally out of proportion to the provocation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Yara,
Sorry, I was just going to kind of add to what Musa was saying and just say that I think people forget the like what is actually happening in Palestine, which Israel is the occupier. So how are they going to defend themselves? Like, how are they going to label it as self-defense against people that they are occupying? And also, just so people know, they do enforce an apartheid system. So Palestinians have essentially no rights at all. Even Israeli Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, they're considered second-class citizens because they're Palestinians. So they have some rights, but less rights than Israelis. There are physical apartheid walls all over to separate Palestinians from one another and from the Israeli community. I also want to talk about how the military is constantly raiding and attacking Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. This isn't something that's like just so suddenly happened on October 7th. They've been enforcing the system for 75 years.
And yeah, so I think Musa told me a few days ago that there's a difference between Israeli citizens and Israeli nationals. And if you're only a citizen and not a national, you cannot get a permit to maintain your house. So if you repair the roof, for example, they come without a permit, which you cannot get as a Palestinian. They come out and bulldoze your house down. What?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, I've heard, but that's not.
Yeah.
That's not reported in the major media, right?
But let me give you more on what Musa is saying.
And, we've got another 90 seconds.
Okay, and yeah, being under occupation, there is a law that if you occupy a country, you have to deal with their security of the people you occupy. And the Israelis, it's not that they occupy us, but also they feel that they have the right to kill us.
Right.
And that...
Sadly, we'll have to leave it there. We've been visiting with three people asking for a ceasefire in the current Israel-Hamas war, Musa El-Bayoumi, Yara Salamet, and Mubarak Awad. Musa is an MD and chair of the board of the Kansas chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Kansas. Yara is a law student at UMKC and president of Students for Justice in Palestine there. Mubarak founded Nonviolence International after he was expelled from Palestine for organizing nonviolent protests against mistreatment by Israeli military and settlers. Tune in next week. Of course, the problems is that part doesn't appear in the major media, that the most Israelis and most U.S. That mistreatment isn't reported, and most of the media reported consumed by Israelis and U.S. citizens. Tune in next week to hear Kerry O'Rourke discuss the social genocide of the Hizmet people by the government of Turkey today. I'm Spencer Graves. Craig LeBeau is at the controls. Thank you for listening.